We interrupt this broadcast with some important news.
Let's rewind and check out the biggest news stories from this week. It's time for Taiwan This Week.
Good evening and welcome to Taiwan This Week with me, your host Gavin Phipps. And I'm joined in the studio this evening by Xiao Xin Cheng.
Good to be here.
And by Ross Feingold.
Good evening.
And we'll begin today's show with the Constitutional Court on Tuesday, debating whether the current death penalty system is, well, constitutional. The debates are attorneys representing 37 prisoners currently on death row who are challenging the constitutionality of capital punishment. The 37 petitioners argue that the presence and implementation of capital punishment violates Article 15 of the Constitution of the ROC, which stipulates the right of existence shall be guaranteed to the people. Now, the head of the Ministry of Justice's Department of Prosecutorial Affairs, Guo Yongfu, led a team of three to defend the current practice. Now, the case was initiated by a 71-year-old man who is on death row for his involvement in the killing of two police officers in 1990, and it was brought to the Constitutional Court in 2022, and the court later decided to combine his case with those of the 36 other death row inmates. Needless to say, the DPP and the KMT are taking very different sides on the matter, and lawmakers from the two main parties clashed over the issue on Wednesday, with KMT lawmaker Lord Jia Chung telling reporters that the question as to whether or not the death penalty should be abolished is the responsibility of the legislative UN, and any decision should be guided by public opinion, while the DPP Legislative Caucus Secretary-General Wu Siyao told reporters in a separate press conference that her party firmly believes that the Constitutional Court's ability to make an appropriate ruling on the matter will be based on the law and social consciousness. Now, according to the Constitutional Court Procedure Act, a majority of the justices presiding over the case have to rule in favour of the petitioners for the death penalty to be overturned, and reports are saying a decision on the matter could be expected within the coming 3 months at the earliest. So, Ross, the DPP government has for many years said it wants to abolish the death penalty, but this has gone to the Constitutional Court for a ruling by the court, as opposed to lawmakers simply ticking a box and putting in a box in the legislative chamber.
I'm going to say something that we'll probably say many times on the show in the coming months and years, which is if the DPP doesn't like something or they wanted to do something, they had 8 years to do it when they had unified government. The president was from the DPP. DPP had a large majority in the legislative UN, both after the 2016 and 2020 election. So they had 8 years of unified government. And this is a party that for a long, long time has said they are anti-death penalty. But whenever someone says, well, why didn't you do something about it when you had unified government, when you controlled the presidency and the legislature, they always give this long soliloquy about, well, we need to find societal consensus. There is a societal consensus because polls continually show that the public overwhelmingly supports the death penalty. However, given that they had unified government, again, the DPP could have practiced what they preach. And if they really were opposed to the death penalty, as they say they are, and Legislator Wu Siyao's comments indicate that the party is still opposed to the death penalty and supports its abolition, well, for the last 8 years, why didn't they take care of this?
It could have taken 5 minutes, Ross, and not 3 months.
I agree with you, Gavin. They could have disposed of this issue very quickly. And again, if it is something that they passionately believe in, and I respect that, although personally I'm in favor of the death penalty, but if that this is a core policy platform that the DPP has consistently said they believe in and that they campaigned on that through many elections, again, you have to question, well, why didn't you take care of this when you had the chance?
So, Xiao, why didn't they do it over the past 8 years?
Well, I think Ross just gave out the answer, which is the polls overwhelmingly showing that Taiwanese people still are in favor of death penalty. And DPP is known to be a party that is pretty apt to running and winning elections. So adhering or listening to the polls or the will of people is a very strong ability in terms of that. But in terms of the death penalty issue, the effort, it ultimately comes down to it's a constitutional question, right? Because just like the same-sex marriage issue, it is very thorny, but still, it is a constitutional question. It's not issued not be up to the popular opinion, correct? Because if it's constitutional or not, it's up to the constitutional court to decide. So although the DPP is always in favor of abolishing the death penalty, but I think it's wise to, for them to leave it up to the court to decide.
Yeah, in English, we call that a cop-out, right? Instead of being bold enough to make a decision and do something and follow their own beliefs, they're basically going to do a cop-out and throw it over to the constitutional court.
But could the DPP be doing it? Could it did it with the same-sex marriage, of course. It took that to the constitutional court. Now it's taken the death penalty to the constitutional court. Could this be a sort of a secret, for a stupid word to use, ploy by the DPP to actually revise the constitution?
I don't think it's a ploy to revise the Constitution. Generally, this has to do with revising relevant laws. So the debate during the marriage equality court case that went to the Constitutional Court, as you said, was what ultimately became whether or not the civil code should provide for marriage equality or it should be passed in a dedicated law. And eventually, you know, the Constitutional Court ruled that it's you have a constitutional right to marry in a heterosexual or a homosexual relationship. And they said, legislature will give you 2 years to put this in law. So the legislature had the option of revising the civil code or passing a dedicated law. Ultimately, they chose the latter. They passed a dedicated law and left the civil code as is. But for the death penalty, they would have to change relevant criminal laws to eliminate the death penalty as a penalty and change that to, you know, life imprisonment, for example. But ultimately, no matter how long we talk about this in this segment, the fact remains that the DPP had a chance to fix this, and they didn't do it. And it's you know, Xiao talked about domestic politics, but we also have to talk about the foreign relations aspect, because whenever Taiwan has carried out an execution, and there's been a couple under the 8 years of the Tsai administration, even though there's nearly 40 on death row, they only executed, I believe, two in the past 8 years. The European Union really comes out with a rapid and quite critical response, since the European Union opposes the death penalty and it's not practiced in any EU countries anymore. But every time Taiwan does this, does an execution, then there's a lot of criticism from the EU. So, you know, we could see that the government just doesn't want to deal with that, right? So they take a cop out and they don't want the flack from the EU. Interestingly, had they executed more people when Trump was in office, the US would have been like, yeah, go for it, because the Trump administration was pro-death penalty. So they would have gotten even more points with the United States had they used the death penalty more frequently during the Trump presidency. But now, if they eliminate it, they'd also get some loving. You know, if they had eliminated it legislatively in recent years, they would have gotten a lot of loving from the Biden administration, because the Biden administration is not pro-death penalty. So lost opportunity, really, however you analyze this. Lost opportunity specifically for President Tsai and the DPP.
And Xiao, of course, if the Constitutional Court does say, yeah, it should be overturned. Reports, like I said, a decision could be made in 3 months for that. But I mean, how long do you actually think it would take for, like Ross said, for them to repeal the laws needed, for it to go to the legislature, for it to be reviewed by the experts before they actually repeal the death penalty?
Oh, it's going to take a long, long time. Just like last time, like Russ pointed out, when they need to amend some of the laws in terms of the same-sex marriage, there's a lot of arguing and bickering back and forth. So, but the good thing is the Constitutional Court did set a time limit, so the legislative yuan would have the pressure to make things happen. But if it actually runs straight into the next election or the local elections, and that's where the both party are worried about, so they were really, really not touch that thorny issue. But as I said, if the Constitutional Court do give a final decision, I think the legislative yuan will have no choice but to obey by it.
Yeah, but Gavin, keep in mind that if the Constitutional Court is to rule that the death penalty is unconstitutional in order to the legislative yuan to make the relevant changes to laws, there can't be any executions after that ruling, right? So there would be an immediate ban, and the instruction from the Constitutional Court would be fix the sections of relevant laws. But again, if they rule it's unconstitutional, then you can't carry out executions during the period between the court decision and when the relevant laws are changed. So there would be an immediate ban on death penalty.
But they would be hanging there, though.
Was that a joke? Because they don't use hanging in Taiwan. They don't use hanging. They use a gunshot to the back of the head, Gavin.
It was a pun, but it would be hanging there because lawmakers would have to take action.
Yeah, but during that, again, if the court finds it unconstitutional, it's immediately unconstitutional. So they can't carry out any executions during that period.
And do you think someone else could come along and say, hey, can we rule on this again?
And not likely. I think that this will kill the issue. No pun intended.
Moving on now, and President-elect Lai Ching-te on Thursday of this week announced the appointment of the leading members of his national security team. Now, National Security Council Secretary-General Wellington Gu will serve as defence minister when the new administration takes office on May the 20th. Incumbent Foreign Minister Joseph Wu will return to his previous post as Secretary-General of the National Security Council. And former Taichung Mayor Lin Jialong will serve as Foreign Minister. Of course, we knew about these three, but they were confirmed this week, Ross. And Ross was really, really excited.
Oh, well, the excitement is beyond words to see same old faces. They're just shifting chairs. I mean, Lin Jialong, as you mentioned, was a mayor of Taichung who got voted out after one term. Okay, this is very rare in Taiwan for an incumbent office holder, especially municipal leaders, whether it's the cities or the counties, to be voted out after one term. That means you really pissed off the voters. And in Lin Jialong's case in 2018, when he got voted out after his first term, the big issue in Taichung was air pollution from the coal electrical plants powered by coal. But he then became Minister of Transportation and Communications, and he had to resign from that job after the train accident that had many fatalities. This all just proves that two things. One, past failures as a politician in Taiwan is no barrier to staying in politics in Taiwan. And two, it also proves that the DPP, to their credit, they're very good at giving jobs out to people on the team. And people on the team who may have fallen on hard times, like getting voted out by the voters, they still get rewarded with another job. And the DPP is very, very good at this. And that's why we see some of the same faces coming back into these various jobs, and they're just shifting over from different jobs. Lin Jialong, to his credit, I guess he's held a number of jobs in local and central government or in the party, like a lot of DP people have. So he knows how to maneuver through the government. But having the immediate past office holder, Joseph Wu, shift over to National Security Council Secretary General, and keeping in mind that former representative to the United States, Xiao Bikim, is going to be the vice president, I think we're going to have to be very concerned about the possibility of having three foreign ministers, because not only is Lin Jialong the foreign minister, but we have Joseph Wu and Xiao Bikim, who are, to be fair, they're experts in this area. They have a lot of personal relationships with foreign dignitaries. So how the dynamics work between these various people in the conduct of Taiwan's foreign policy is going to be a question mark and worth watching.
So Xiao, three foreign ministers. So who do you think is going to greet the foreign guests? Who's going to host the banquet? And who's going to have the nitty-gritty talks with them?
Oh, yeah, it's definitely Lin Jialong. He is the appointed foreign minister. And just been following on what Ross said, that DPP is very good at giving out jobs. It's actually a well-known, historical background that DPP is ruled by factions. And Lin Jialong is actually the head of one of the factions, Zheng Guohui. So it's definitely he's going to get a cabinet post. But everybody just was keep guessing which one is it. And when it came out that he was going to be appointed as a foreign minister, everybody was quite surprised. I think Ross was included, because he really lacks expertise in this area. But on the other hand, it is. I think the backstory may be that the President Lai has been talking with Lin Jialong for a long time, persuading him, trying to accept this post. So I think it's still very clear that he is going to get a post. It's just not sure which one is it. But in the end, I think because DPP has the history of ruling by factions, Lin Jialong being the head of Zheng Guohui, it's very reasonable that he get a post.
And what could go wrong, Ross?
Well, Xiao pointed out a lack of experience with foreign policy issues, notwithstanding that he has an advanced degree from the United States, which, to be clear, I don't think that's enough. That should not be the only qualification to somebody becoming foreign minister, that they studied overseas for a few years. But again, what could go wrong? Well, like I said earlier, that we have several people in the government who have strong personal relationships with overseas dignitaries, members of Congress in the United States, other parliamentarians. And there's a trend for the same parliamentarians to visit Taiwan multiple times. So, for example, I think the president of the French Senate was here multiple times, and Central and Eastern European parliamentarians, there's several who have come here multiple times in the last few years. So, again, these people, they all know outgoing Foreign Minister Joseph Wu, and he's going to want to see these people when they come to Taipei, but the foreign minister is supposed to see them as well. And then when it comes to Americans, and especially members of the U.S. Congress coming to Taiwan, again, Xiao Bikim knows these people from her work in Washington, D.C. So how the dynamics work in the three foreign minister setup, which I mentioned, really remains to be seen.
And of course, Ross, I mean, if Beijing starts to poach Taiwan's remaining diplomatic allies, how many is it going to take for Lin Jialong to fall on his sword and put his hands up and say, okay, I'll take responsibility?
Well, Gavin, you really expect him to fall on his sword at some point. You know, give the guy a chance, right? Maybe he'll surprise us and he'll do really well, and there won't be any loss of diplomatic allies, although frankly it does seem kind of inevitable, and you know, there'll be speculation about which country is next in line. Recent history shows that every year or two, China poaches one or two away, and there's some obvious candidates on that list to make that switch. Will he resign? Well, Joseph Wu didn't have to resign, so the immediate precedent is that the foreign minister doesn't have to resign when, for example, upcoming, you say it could be Haiti, could be Tuvalu. The foreign minister usually doesn't have to resign nowadays.
And Xiao, where do you think his first trip's going to be to? Where's he going to go first?
Well, I won't venture into a guess, but I think he wouldn't take any heat for losing any diplomatic allies, because right now the focus is all on the unofficial, you know, diplomatic alliances with Japan, Philippines, and the United States, right? Especially with the passage of a huge package of aid coming to Taiwan's way from the United States government. I think Lin Jialong is going to have his hand full with dealing with, you know, all these unofficial diplomatic alliances forming in the Pacific region. So I think that's where he will kind of focus his energy. And I wouldn't be surprised if he makes the trip first, his trip, in terms of strengthening the alliance in the Pacific region.
But there's no country he could go to.
That is true.
Right? He can't go to Japan.
That is true.
Japan never welcomes ministerial level officials to visit. And Southeast Asia, certainly they have a very fixed one China policy. I mean, the ASEAN countries, they never say anything publicly supportive of Taiwan. They never, for example, say that they support Taiwan's substantive participation at the WHO meetings. So where else could he go other than stop off in the U.S. on his way to the Caribbean or Paraguay? They're really limited options.
And Ross, now, what about Wellington Gu as defense minister?
Well, the issue there is he's not a career soldier, and up to now, the defense minister has universally been a former career soldier who reached the highest levels of the military, chief of the general staff, for example, and then retires and becomes a defense minister, trades in their uniform for a suit and tie. So on the one hand, it's good that thinking has now been broken, and it's a positive development to have a civilian head the Ministry of National Defense. On the other hand, the downside is he has no experience with the many issues that confront the next defense minister. He has served some time as a National Security Council Secretary General. That is not the equivalent of being the defense minister, though. So he's going to have a very steep learning curve.
And Xiao, what do you think? Because a civilian running the military. Obviously, it's turned some heads in the past few weeks when it was talked about.
Yeah, it definitely does. I think it's an excellent choice, because he's been like the intelligence community. Also, he served as financial supervisory commissioner. So he's got vast experience in the government and has a lot of connections. And along the way, we don't hear much, scandals or anything about him that's going to affect his ability to carry out his cabinet post. So I think this being the true first civilian leading the defense ministry, I think it's an excellent choice. And we are all waiting to see what will turn out.
What about the military themselves, though, Xiao? I mean, what do you think the military hierarchy is thinking of this?
Yeah, I think the military is going to take some time to get used to this because, as you may recall, when Chai Ing-wen came to power, the military, take some period to warm up to our first female president. So this is going to be the same. It's going to take some time to warm up to our first civilian defense minister. But I think our military is constantly changing, right? Although we can recall that the mandatory service being changed from a full month for the young person to back to 1 year. So it shows, Taiwan's commitment to boot out our military manpower. And as a lot of reforms taking place in the military as well, because if you recall, back in the Sunflower Movement, it all started because, there's abuse in the military that caused a lot of major protests on the streets. And since that time, a lot of reforms taking place. So this all leads up to, the choice of Gu being the first civilian to lead the ministry. But I think it's going to keep going to the direction of continuing reform.
Well, recently, the outgoing Minister of National Defense, Chiu Kuo-chung, was asked about removing the Chiang Kai-shek statues from military bases, and he said no. So, Xiao, when you talk about reform, I have to say the speed of reform in the military is quite slow. He even said, I consider military facilities to be private property, and no one can tell us to remove our Chiang Kai-shek statues.
Well, one step at a time. Yeah.
We'll get to that. In a bit, Ross, actually. We'll talk about them statues in a bit, just because we'll expound on that. But now we have to continue with the political side of the issue, and President-elect Lai Ching-te this week calling on Beijing to engage with Taiwan's democratically elected and legitimate government to promote cross-strait peace. Speaking to reporters after announcing his national security team, Lai said China needs to be confident and willing to deal with the said democratically elected and said legitimate government entrusted by the people of Taiwan. And he went on to say, only then can exchanges across both sides of the Taiwan Strait proceed on the right path. Now, the comments come, of course, after former President Ma Ying-jeou held talks with Xi Jinping recently in Beijing. KMT Vice Chairman Andrew Shah also visited China recently. And KMT Caucus Whip Fu Quan-chi is leading a delegation of KMT lawmakers to China today. Now, the KMT has been defending the decision to go to China this week, with Fu Quan-chi saying the trip is part of efforts to resume and promote the need for cross-strait exchanges, something that is a priority and should be a priority for all lawmakers. Needless to say, the DPP is rather unhappy about this, and members of the DPP, as well as party-affiliated think tanks this week, had a press conference at which they said that Fu and the KMT are working with Beijing to undermine Taiwan's democracy and national security. The DPP went on to say, it went on to accuse the Taiwan People's Party also of working for the same goal. And one of the DPP lawmakers said, KMT members have made 24 known official visits to China in recent years, while the TPP has made 3 such trips, and questions must be asked if both parties are working to sell out Taiwan by colluding with Xi Jinping. So, Xiao, obviously William Lai, Lai Ching-te saying, maybe Beijing should talk to us and not the opposition. But then the KMT says, hey, all we're doing is talking peace.
Well, yes, but just have to remember that the China is growing its military presence in the entire region, and then especially when the Japanese Prime Minister just visited the United States Congress and give out in the Joint House of Congress and calling on China to be a threat in the region. So it is internationally recognized fact that across the Taiwanese Strait, the threat of military conflict is growing and growing. So under these circumstances, it is still it's questionable for the opposition party to to congregate such a delegation and then to China, especially when there are, you know, local Lijiang, the local principality governors, they are being prosecuted under the anti-infiltration laws, under which it says that if there are any monetary exchanges of you are lobbying on behalf of a Chinese entity, you are liable to maybe commit offenses under this law. So under this all backdrop, it is very it is very questioning why the opposition party is choosing to do such things.
China is not going to talk to the Lai administration unless the Lai administration agrees that the relations between the two sides are governed by the 92 consensus. I mean, it's just as simple as that. So President-elect Lai could even save his breath because he knows what the answer is to what he said about China should be talking to the democratic elected government of Taiwan. China's just not going to talk to the democratically elected government unless the democratically elected government adheres to the 92 consensus. And since the Lai government is not going to adhere to the 92 consensus, then China's not going to talk to it. I think we know the answer, and he could just save everyone's time by not even suggesting this. He probably does need to be a little more clear, though, that he does not support the 92 consensus, and then offer some other framework for China to consider. Otherwise, the two sides are not going to talk. You know, as far as the legislators visiting China, that's their right to do so. Even members of the United States Congress have recently visited China. So as an American, I have to say, if it's good enough for America, I guess it's good enough for Taiwan.
And what about the DPP claims that the TPP and the KMT are working to sell Taiwan?
Well, it's a good talking point, and it's something that the 40% who voted for President Lai probably want to hear and believe in. But the 60% who didn't vote for President Lai will probably disagree with that description of this trip.
And Xiao, do you think the public in Taiwan isn't so angry about this as the DPP? Because, I mean, the general public, they're obviously not stupid people, large numbers of them, and they must realise that unless you talk to the other side, you're not going to make any progress either way.
That is true. That's why President Lai has been suggesting that Beijing talk to the elected government, but not just the former president. And by demonstrating a willingness to talk, I think he's one step in the right direction. Although, just like Ross said, it is actually a fairy tale that to imagine that Beijing will talk to the Lai's government. But still, I mean, President Lai demonstrated, you know, the willingness to talk. What's left to do is for the, you know, the Beijing government to pick up the phone and then call. Still, just like you pointed out, that Taiwanese people, we are risk averse. We don't seek military conflict. But still, we understand that when talking to, you know, Chinese government, there are a lot of pitfalls, right? Whenever you want, you want to construct any bilateral agreements, we have bad experiences on that, right? Because sometimes China will promise you a lot of money, and just in turn, and we all have experienced in terms of previous trade agreements, and what would come out of that is that they will just sell you a lot of cheap goods, and then to fill out the market with cheap labor. So we went through that in terms of the moment of the Sunflower Movement. And we are very mindful and cautious in repeating the history again.
Well, we could talk about this for a lengthy period of time, but ultimately, as, you know, Xiao said, we're talking about a fairy tale. But, you know, there's another aspect to this conversation, which is, okay, the two governments are not going to talk to each other, and, you know, there's not going to be any high-level visits from China to Taiwan by government people. But at the working level, the two sides do need to cooperate sometimes. I mean, the recent incidents off Jinmen are a good example, where the Chinese sailors died, and there needs to be some discussion between the two sides about handling the situation. So let's hope that even if the high-level interaction doesn't occur, the kind of working level interaction that does need to occur will actually proceed. But even that could be at risk and isn't easy to achieve.
And we talked about statues there, or rather Ross was talking about statues, so we'll talk about statues. And the government this week announced that it plans to speed up the removal of statues of Chiang Kai-shek from public places. The statement came as the Deputy Director General of the Cabinet's Department of Human Rights and Transitional Justice was being grilled by lawmakers at a hearing of the Legislative Internal Administration Committee. Now, the Transitional Justice Committee, a body created by the Tsai administration in May of 2018 and disbanded in May of 2022, announced plans to remove all of the Jung statues from public spaces shortly after it, well, it became an entity. Needless to say, though, that never happened. And that's irked the DPP lawmaker Huang Jie, who has accused the Cabinet Department of inaction over its failure to act fast enough on the Transitional Justice Committee's recommendation regarding the statues. And according to Huang, only 165 of the 934 listed statues in public spaces have so far been removed. So, Ross, removing statues, big issue.
This is kind of like the death penalty discussion, though, that under unified government, where the DPP controlled the legislature and the presidency for 8 years, why didn't they do something about it then? It almost comes across as they're saving it. They save it for these kinds of things for election periods, and then they're trying to build up some reservoir of goodwill for new President Lai. Like, one of the first things he does is remove the Chiang Kai-shek statues, and he's trying to get some points with at least the 40% that voted for him. Maybe he'll get some points with additional people as well. But again, I don't know why this is taking so long. It's been discussed for many, many years, and sure, there's some people in Taiwan who still feel that Chiang Kai-shek and his son Chiang Jing-guo are worthy of this kind of respect and veneration, and that it's inappropriate to remove the statues. But I think most people realize that it's weird in 2024 to still have this kind of reverence for two dictators.
Well, to be honest, a lot of statues have been removed, right? If you visited the Daxi Memorial Park, it is actually a graveyard of all Chiang Kai-shek statues lying all over the place. So it was happening. So because back, I remember when I was an elementary student, I couldn't go any places in Taiwan or Taipei without seeing multiple of Chiang Kai-shek statues all over the place. So it has been happening. And if some still remain today, I mean, there are going to be backstories to it. Maybe just some local people who are so in love with all those statues and they fought to protect them. So they may be difficult. If it were easy to remove, I believe the government would have removed them already. So the remaining ones, they may be harder to remove. And I think the government's working on it. But I think the major issue would be the Chiang Kai-shek Memorial Hall, right? That's the major focal point. So because there's a major, the largest Chiang Kai-shek statue in Taiwan, sitting in just right in the center of the hall. And every year, millions of tourists visit. So a lot of my international friends are questioning why we worship such a dictator, just like Rush pointed out, and we still spend taxpayer dollar to protect the statue and all have all these change of guards going on every day for the tourists to see. And especially in Daxi, we still pay the taxpayer dollars to protect the still embalmed, unburied body of Chiang Kai-shek. So this is all, if you think about it, the victims' families or the white terror victims' families are also part of the taxpayers' dollar going into protecting the very same dictator who murdered their families. So this is why this is still a very touchy and sensitive issue, and it needs to be addressed properly going forward.
I'm going to have to disagree with Xiao. If there's still over 700 statues, I don't think that we could say they're making progress, or we should say that the progress is extraordinarily slow. Again, if the government over the past 8 years was serious about doing this, then they could have gotten rid of removed every single one and deposited them in the graveyard of Chiang Kai-shek statues.
Are they lying down there on the grass?
No, they're upright.
Because I went there about 2000 something, 2005, yeah.
Right.
And they were actually, it looked quite nice. They put them all, they were all on their own stands and everything. There wasn't many of them then, but they were all on their own stands, and it was quite a nice place to go.
Yes, but if you go today, you will see the densities increase many fold. So it's very packed and crowded with statues. And Well, there's some statues still lying around in Taiwan, and that's why every year in 228, you see a lot of people attacking those statues. And that is going to happen, and that's going to remind Taiwanese people why we still need to have the statues lying around.
And Ross, who should Taiwan have statues of? Because, of course, it needs statues. Every capital city has statues. Where I come from, we've got a statue of George Washington. So we've got statues of just about everybody.
I thought your country went to war with George Washington.
Apparently it was given to my country in 1921, but they put it up in London.
Okay. Well, Lee Teng-hui might be a worthy person since he was, you know, what people often call the father of Taiwan's democracy and oversaw the transition from dictatorship to a democratic society. Of course, there are some things people don't like about Lee Teng-hui's presidency, including the what they call black gold, the corruption. But other than him, I'm struggling to think of
Wang Jingping. Everybody loved Wang Jingping.
Everyone likes him, but he's still alive, and I think statues should probably go be made for people who have passed away already. It's a little weird to have statues of people who are still alive, especially political people. I think usually it's an honor that they deserve after they pass away. I don't hear anyone eager to see a Chen Shui-bian or a Ma Ying-jeou statue, or for that matter, a Tsai Ing-wen statue.
And Xiao, who do you think Taiwan should have as a statue?
Well, in Tainan, there's a park where when they remove the Chiang Kai-shek statue, they replace with statue of Tang De Zhang, who is a victim of the White Terror era. He was a local doctor and loved by everybody. So there may be a trend of replacing the Chiang Kai-shek statue with statues memorizing the victims of the White Terror era. But that's in the past. But going forward, if we were to have a statue commemorating, you know, people who, you know, contribute to Taiwan's, you know, democracy or identity. I agree with Ross that Lee Teng-hui is a good figure. But actually, I would like to point out that in Linkou, besides the Ministry Building, there's actually a park with a statue of Tsai Ing-wen and maybe Chen Shui-bian, you know, all those historical figures. Oh. Everybody's welcome to visit.
Maybe Morris Zhang, since, you know, he's done so much for Taiwan's economy by creating TSMC. Maybe he deserves a statue.
The APEC man. As he's known.
Yeah, he just got an award for that from President Tsai. He was awarded one of those orders with the interesting names. I would take a guess that in the years after he passes away, and let's hope he doesn't pass away anytime soon, that there would be statues for him.
And where would they be? In Taipei?
I guess the Hsinchu Science Park.
And before we go this week, outgoing Environment Minister Xue Fu Sheng said this past weekend, well, he was touting the decline in use of plastic shopping bags over the past two decades. And speaking at an event in Taipei organised to encourage reducing plastic use, he said that the use of plastic shopping bags has dropped by more than half since regulations to restrict their use were first introduced in 2002. Now, according to Xue, 9 billion plastic shopping bags were used in 2023, and that figure is down from the 20 billion used in 2002. He said the government has restricted the use of plastic bags at over 14 kinds of institutions, and they include the public sector, private schools, shopping malls, hypermarkets, convenience store chains, fast food restaurant chains, beverage stores and bakeries. And he also said the government plans to further reduce plastic consumption by expanding the range of restricted locations to include traditional wet markets, night markets, food stalls at night markets, and even breakfast restaurants from next year. So, Ross, plastic problem, mate. Get rid of plastic.
Well, to be fair, this restriction has been successful, as indicated by the data points, but there's still a long way to go because there's still a lot of plastic bag usage, as you also mentioned. I just came back from Hong Kong, where they're about to implement some strict rules on single-use cutlery. And there's a lot of opposition to it. So I think Taiwan, to its credit, not just a smart government policy, but also the public. The public deserves some credit for being supportive of these policies. And I think most people know that you're either going to have to pay money for a plastic bag or you should try to bring your own, try and save. Many people probably have a bag full of bags at home so that people know when you go to the wet market in the future, then you have to prepare your own bag.
Now, Xiao, I'm going to throw this at you, mate. Here we go. Now, while going to, the 7-Eleven, people might accept not being able to get a bag. But when people go to the wet market and to night markets and food stalls, do you think there might be a bit of pushback about not having a bag to put the food in you're taking away?
Oh, definitely. I mean, when I heard wet markets, it's kind of surprising because, well, when you go to 7-Eleven or a supermarket, the food are prepackaged, so it's okay. You can go without a plastic bag. But if you go to a wet market and buy a slab of pork feet with the blood dripping down, how are you gonna manage with it carrying just on your bare hand? So, well, I think there's some sort of policy gonna go along with that. You can just ban it outright. So I think that's that for me.
And Ross, if you pop off to the night market near your house and you decide to buy a lovely oyster omelette, would you expect it in a plastic bag? Because, of course, a paper bag you'd end up with all over your shirt in about 5 seconds.
Well, just eat it faster, Gavin. Wouldn't that be the solution? Wolf it down.
They'd have the sign then. No plastic bags, just eat fast.
Yeah, or put it on a skewer of some sort, right? A wooden stick.
But do you think there might be pushback in certain places, like night markets?
Yeah, there'll be definitely be pushback, but there are options, right? Either you pay to buy a bag, no matter what the price is, a few NT dollars, or you bring your own. And again, I think for those stores where plastic bags have been banned, those supermarkets and other types of establishments, people have gotten used to it. And people know that you either have to prepare, bring your own bag, or you have to pay to buy a bag.
Because, of course, now in Taipei and New Taipei and various other parts of the island, you have special garbage bags. Had them for many years. But now when you go shopping and if you're at the supermarket and you buy your groceries, you can buy a plastic bag, and it's a garbage bag that you can throw in the back of the garbage truck.
Exactly. So people do learn to live with these policies. It's a smart policy. It's good for the environment. And I think people are generally willing to accommodate the new policy.
But Xiao, I still go to my local family mart near the office, and I can still see straws in there.
Oh, yeah, the straws. But I see many more paper straws and other straws made out of cans, for example. So I think people start to change and accept, some inconvenience in terms of a better environment. And I'm all looking on the bright side for it.
And that's where we'll leave it here this week on Taiwan This Week. And I've been joined in the studio today by Xiao Xing Cheng.
Good night, everyone.
And by Ross Feingold.
Have a great weekend.
And thanks for tuning in to this week's edition of Taiwan This Week here on ICRT with me, Gavin Phipps. And don't forget to check out Taiwan This Week podcast on your favourite podcast app when you get access to all our previous shows.
Tune in again next Friday evening at 9 for another informative look at the top stories of the week with Taiwan This Week. And don't forget to also check out our podcast on our website, icrt.com.tw. Now keep it here for more music and news only on ICRT FM 100.